Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Hello, everyone. Welcome, and hello those of you who are joining on screen from your homes. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Tova, T-O-V-A, Tova Green. I'm very happy to be back at Canando, and there's some faces I remember very well from before, and some of you I haven't met yet, so thank you for coming to the Zendo tonight, and thanks for tuning in at home. Just a little about me. I practiced at San Francisco Zen Center and as a resident for 26 years, and on last March, almost a year ago, I left my sangha there and moved to Healdsburg to live at Enso Village, which is a Zen-inspired senior living community. It's been a big transition for me, and I have slowly found Enso Village to be a very wonderful place to be. And the last job that I had at San Francisco Zen Center brought me in touch with Canando and many other Zen centers in the Suzuki Roshi lineage in this country and many other countries. There are about 80 such Zen centers. And my job was to connect them with each other and with San Francisco Zen Center. It was very joyful. And I stopped working at the end of December, so I'm still getting used to not having that schedule and the kind of interaction with people in so many different parts of the country and world. Can you all hear me? Okay, good. A little bit louder.
Just grab a chair.
So currently I'm taking an online class with someone who was a member of this sangha, Vanessa Abel, and she's teaching a class called Through the Senses, and it's a poetry class, poetry and dharma, and we start with meditation, and she has a theme every time, and then we listen to some poems that she's chosen, and then we have a chance to write and share some of our poems. And the theme this week was on being surprised, and it's relevant to what I'm going to be talking about tonight. But the experience of being surprised is sometimes something we don't like so much, and other times it can be really enjoyable. So, thinking about what surprises you or has surprised you today or this week, it can open up the possibility of something unexpected and also something maybe new or a new way of looking at something very familiar. And what I'm going to be talking about tonight is how we can, or ways in which we can meet one another and all beings in a fresh way. And it has to do with one of the precepts. And that precept is sometimes called speaking of others with openness and possibility. It's also called not talking about others' errors and faults. And the way I learned it initially at San Francisco Zen Center is a disciple of Buddha does not slander. So it is about speech. But before I get into the topic, I'd like to invite you to think about a word. When you hear the word spider, what comes to your mind? And what thoughts, any memories, any feelings about spider? You'll see why I'm talking about spiders in a minute. So there's some words of the Buddha that are relevant to this topic tonight, which I will share. It's from the Dhammapada, which is a collection of some of the Buddha's teachings. It was translated by Gilf Ronsdale, who some of you may know of. He's a teacher not far from here at Insight, an Insight teacher. He's also a Zen teacher. This is the quote, "The thought manifests as the word manifests as the deed develops into habit, and the habit into character. So watch the thought and its ways with care, and let it spring from love, born out of concern for all beings, as the shadow follows the body. As we think, so we become." So sometimes we may not even notice how our thoughts manifest, in our speech and our actions. And I want to share a poem called "For the Love of Spiders," which delves into this. I think it's a really nice way to get into a discussion about how our thoughts may lead us to say things that actually separate us from one another, that may land in a painful way. And this poem was written by Emily Ligren. She's a poet who lives in San Rafael. She was a naturalist and did a lot of outdoor education with young people. I think she still does some, but she's now fully devoting herself to being a poet. And this is her second book, is called "Once I Was a Stone." It's a very beautiful book, and this poem is in that book. And I brought some copies if any of you want a copy later. "For the Love of Spiders." Today, pulling weeds in the garden, I saw a spider whose abdomen and head and legs were bright green, the same shade of plant I'd just rested from the ground. I let out a little gasp as the wind pressed through the grass's spindled seed heads, and I felt a familiar wonder bloom within me, the thought, I have never seen this before. Are you hearing me? Okay. Okay. All right. I have never seen this before. Which comes if I move slowly enough to let myself get drenched in surprise. And suddenly the spider became all the things I don't know yet, climbing the wooden fences at the edge of my brain, woven so delicately with mystery, poise, dew just after rain. And I thought of all the photos of spiders that friends and neighbors have shared on Facebook and Nextdoor. Look at what I found in my house. What should I do with it? The commenters always have the same chorus. Kill it. It's definitely a brown recluse. While my scientist friend and I patiently ask them not to, point out at least 5 observable differences between that spider and the recluse, explain that there are over 3,000 species of spiders in North America, and recluses don't even live in this part of California. Tell them it's probably a colobium, who are so fond of wandering inside come autumn. Resist giving a lecture on how, when you say probably, in science it means you're actually pretty damn sure, but you want to leave some room in case you're wrong. And I thought, there it is again, how easily we press danger on the innocent, on what we don't know. How many people have been killed for looking like a threat when they had done nothing wrong, when they were just existing in their body? How quickly suspicion rises when we're not curious enough, the swiftness with which we reach for hate, how the gun is grasped before one word is spoken. So there's more to the poem, but I'm going to stop there because I think you get the gist of it, that when we see something that is unfamiliar, we may sometimes be frightened of it. We may shut down, we may try to avoid it, or we may attack it. And this all starts with thoughts, but then sometimes turns into words and then sometimes into actions. And this can cause harm. This precept of speaking of others with openness and possibility is in the positive. I really appreciate that way of wording it, and that's from Diane Rizzetto's book on the precepts. Some of you may know this book. It's called Waking Up to What We Do. And she talks about the conversations we have with ourselves, you know, the conversations we have with others, and then how we talk about people and other beings in our communities. And the way in which how we speak to ourselves, how we speak to others, and how we speak in a broader context can make a difference in our actions, how we interact with ourselves, one another, and the wider world. I'm just going to... read a short excerpt from this chapter on speaking of others with openness. In a broader view, this precept invites us to not only speak of, but also meet others with openness and possibility. It is true that speaking disparagingly about another person can have far-reaching effects, but at a deeper level, the mind that is seized by a frozen view of another, even if the thoughts are unspoken, is not capable of being open and awake. So getting back to the words of the Dhammapada, it's if we're thinking about other people, kind of labeling them, even in our mind's eye, oh, this person is unreliable, or that person doesn't seem to care much about anything, or me, or the world. We're narrowing the range of possibilities of getting to know that person or a situation, or being open to meeting someone freshly. So we've already labeled them in our minds, and that label is sometimes all we can, it limits the way we interact with that person. And I just think the spider is a really wonderful metaphor for that. You know, how many people are afraid of spiders, and often when we're afraid, we lash out. So, so she talks about when we dwell on the faults of others, we can place walls between ourselves and other people. And sometimes this precept is referred to as not slandering, so it's not speaking of others' faults. And that's sometimes very easy to slip into, particularly, if you're in a room with people and you're just talking about someone who isn't there, and then someone might say something negative about that person, and sometimes people can bond around that, and then there's kind of an in-group and an out-group, and that kind of response can lead to bullying and to really causing division between ourselves and others. There was a Zen teacher, she's no longer living, Darlene Cohen, who taught at San Francisco Zen Center. She had a great sense of humor. She was married and had a young child who was in her 20s when she developed rheumatoid arthritis and was in a lot of pain much of the time. And she found a way to live with the pain that she wrote about in a very book that has helped many people who have chronic pain. And it's a way of finding something to focus on that brings you joy, even in the midst of pain. And she did workshops on suffering and delight. They were called Suffering and Delight. And even if we don't have chronic pain, we may sometimes experience emotional pain, physical pain, mental pain. And being able in the midst of that to take a look up at the sky or notice a tree or see someone smiling, hear someone laughing, listen to music. There are many ways of finding something that can counteract or balance the pain that you're in, or remind you that that's not all there is, you know. I want to share something she wrote. It's called No Harm in a Little Gossip, right? That's why I'm talking about Darlene, because she wrote this essay. It was published in one of the Buddhist magazines, maybe Tricycle. And she talked about how she and a friend would get together, and sometimes they would talk about a mutual friend who wasn't there. And Darlene used to really enjoy gossiping and talking about this friend. And then one time she and the other person were talking about this friend in a very disparaging way. And this second person told the mutual friend what Darlene had said. And the friend contacted Darlene and told Darlene how upset she was by what Darlene had said. And Darlene really cared about the friendship, so she resolved after that to really take a look at what led her to say those things and even to think those things. And she began exploring. And I'll just read a little bit from this article. The tremendous shame that I felt about my remarks to my gossip buddy centered on the fact that I'd been willing to sacrifice my friend's standing with him for something as trivial as an opportunity to turn a phrase. I also became aware for the first time that I had always felt shame when I spoke badly of someone, a little ka-chung in my heart. But because the shame seemed tiny compared with the reward of being thought clever, I'd always kept on talking. So at that point, she decided she was not going to gossip any longer. She did an investigation of what was going on internally for her when she was gossiping. And sometimes she wanted someone to think she was clever or wanted someone to agree with her about someone else's fault. And so she stopped doing that. And I think when it's so easy to fall into being critical of someone, particularly when they're not in the room, and sometimes saying things you would not or you might not say to them directly. And it can create this us versus them dynamic. So and Diane Rossetto talked about this further in that it creates, it can contribute to stereotyping others, even to hatred and sometimes to war. And we're seeing that now in our country and the world. So how can we practice with this tendency our mind may have to have a fixed view of another person or another being? One of the ways is to pay very close awareness to what we're noticing and to be able to slow down sometimes in a conversation to be curious, to approach a person, or even someone you know very well, with kind of beginner's mind. What if you were meeting this person for the first time? What would you want to know, or what would you, what might you talk about? What might you ask? And, you know, I find living in a new community, there are now about 300 people living in this community. When I moved in a year ago, there were only 200, but it's been filling up. And I notice there are some people I'm drawn to and others less so. But what I find is if I have an opportunity to sit with someone at a meal who's a stranger, even if it's someone I'm not drawn to, I always find something that we have in common or something really interesting about that person. And so sometimes I make a point of seeking out someone I'm not drawn to, just to see what's my idea of this person, and it usually is just an idea. It's it can be based on very little, actually. But I imagine each of you might have had that kind of experience of a prejudging someone that you don't really know. So recognizing those thoughts when they arise, and then sometimes, just not fixating on them, not thinking, well, that this is the truth, or this is, how that person is, and also remembering that we're always changing. Everyone is, changes. Part of life, and then sometimes when there's a difficult topic to talk about in a group, in our community, there have been some things that have come up that have been difficult. And when I lived at the Zen Center, we sometimes had sharing circles where we would come together in a circle. We did this once at Enso Village when someone who many people admired and enjoyed, a staff person, was let go, fired. And there was very little said to the residents about why, and it was very upsetting. And so we gathered in concentric circles, and we had a few chairs in the middle, and people could go and sit and talk about their thoughts, their feelings about what was happening. And not everybody got a chance to talk because it was a large group, but I felt when people spoke, they often spoke for me. And that's one way of doing a sharing circle. Another is, maybe you've done that here, a council, where you sit in a circle and you have a question that you're addressing. And there are very few guidelines, but sometimes it's like sitting around a campfire. You might have a plant in the middle or some flowers, and you pass an object around, and everyone is invited to speak from the heart and to listen from the heart without planning what you're going to say when it's your turn. So that kind of listening can really be helpful in a community when there's something difficult to talk about. So I think what I'm going to do is go back to the poem and read you the rest of it, rather than starting from the beginning. I'll just back up to the last stanza I read after she talked about scientists. And I thought, there it is again. How easily we press danger on the innocent, on what we don't know. How many people have been killed for looking like a threat when they had done nothing wrong? When they were just existing in their body, how quickly suspicion rises when we're not curious enough. The swiftness with which we reach for hate. How the gun is grasped before one word is spoken. How the first sentence of every Google search preview about every kind of spider says whether it is venomous or not. I, who have loved spiders since I was 10, looked for them everywhere, studied their webs in wonder, am asking you to move more slowly. I want every person you ever meet to wear a necklace engraved with the words, "You have never seen me before. Take tender care." I want to replace all the sentences about all spiders with that sentence. I want the message to look you right in the face, so you remember to treat everyone like something bright and green and new, worthy of your slow attention. Even the spider at the corner of your closet, even someone you were told to fear, even your best friend or aging mother, who you think you know, but have actually never seen before, as they are on this spring day, so full of pollen and dew. So I'd like to end there and open up the time for hearing your thoughts about either spiders or this precept or experiences you've had, you know, with prejudging or a situation. Lee?
So going back to childhood, I had in the apartment or house that we lived in, I had a little bedroom with one window. And sometimes I would see a spider in that window. And I would call my older brother and ask him to come and take it away. And he would catch the said spider and take it outside and let it go. And so I've kind of grown up feeling like, you know, when we see spiders, we have some kind of gut reaction of fear because they have so many legs and they don't, you know, they don't have a face that we can, you know, get a sense of who they are. But I just started keeping a spider jar in my house with a piece of cardboard and just, you know, put the glass over the spider, slide the cardboard in, and just take them outside. So I have this thing now where I would never think of killing a spider just because it was sitting in the corner of my bedroom or something like that. I would take the challenge of finding a humane way to trap the spider in some vessel that I can remove to the outdoors. So that is my, you know, emotional life with spiders.
Thank you for sharing that. And well, it seems like your brother had that.
Yeah.
Respect and passed it on to you.
And he taught me, you know, not to panic because it was something so strange looking to us.
And the will show up one who is leaving for Zazen in the morning.
Anybody else have something they want to add?
When I was cleaning up after making tea one time, there was a spider, and I forgot his name, but there was some member. I was going to step on the spider, and he picked it up and took it outside. And another time, there was a spider, and this other member stepped on it. And I told him about the previous member's experience, and he said it was his time.
What did you think about that?
So I think that I was catching spiders and releasing them out my back door, and it's kind of a sheltered area, and it became so littered with spiders. They liked it in that sheltered spot, and I've started decimating them as well.
How does it feel when you do that?
How does it feel? Like I'm getting rid of a possible thing that's going to bug me later on.
Thank you for sharing.
It's just different takes on the same problem.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you, Tova, for your talk. I know it's not just about spiders, but the images we put on other people and how we react or judge before we really know them. But getting back to spiders, I have a little vacuum. It's a long tube with a battery and a button. And when I press the button, the spider is sucked into the little tube, and then I take it and carry it out to the garden. So I think, you know, we can find a spot for them somewhere. But we do grow up with a fear of spiders, and I think our prejudice is the same. You know, we grow up with opinions and ideas about certain people, and I really admire you recognizing someone you're not drawn to and seeking them out and spending time with them for that reason, because it's often something in us that causes us to be repulsed or not drawn to someone. There's something going on inside of ourselves, so I think it's an opportunity to learn something about ourselves in mm-hmm. doing that, you know, like exposing yourself mm-hmm. to things you are uncomfortable with. So yeah. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
And the lovely poem, really lovely.
I can tell you I'll tell a little story about when I first came to Enso Village. There's an area off the dining room where you could eat in a kind of smaller, quieter place. And I went there to have lunch. And there was someone at a table with a large man with a woman who looked very frail. And there was a parrot, a very large bird on the shoulder of the man, and it would make this shriek periodically. And I really was surprised and appalled. And I wanted to say something to him, which would not have been very kind. Like, why are you bringing this parrot to a public space? And later I found out that this parrot had been his wife's parrot for a very long time, and she was very frail. And he knew how happy it made her to be in the presence of the parrot. And I was then very glad I didn't speak what I was thinking. And just because, and you know, I could have asked him about it, but I know when I'm kind of angry or indignant, you know, this is not the right place for the parrot, it would have not come out. I would have offended him. Mm-hmm. So I was glad I didn't say it. And that parrot is much beloved at Enso Village, actually, because people understand the meaning of the parrot. So sometimes I find, especially if something really annoys me, if I can wait and be curious, okay, what's this triggering in me? And generally find out a little bit more mm-hmm. about what's happening with the other person, it has a better outcome. I can say. Is there anyone else who has a question or comment? It doesn't have to be about spiders. Anyone online who would like to? Can people online ask a question?
I don't know if they're.
I don't see anyone raising their hand. But does anyone have any thoughts about that precept about meeting others with openness, or not featuring other people's faults? Yes, John.
I have a sister, and she would, younger sister, and for her whole life she said, "John, you're so critical." And I was astrologically, and I'm a certain sign that's supposedly very critical, and she'd bring it up when I'd see her, and so it's probably the thing I've worked the most on, and I'm sort of somewhat proud of myself. I think I'm a lot less critical because of her admonition repeatedly over the years. I think I've really worked on it, mm-hmm. and it's such a freeing, liberating thing to not, as you've described, maybe you see somebody and you have some imagination about that your personalities are not going to jive or for some reason. And it's often absolutely wrong. And so anyway, I've worked on that very specific thing, and I'm glad I have. It really makes life a lot better. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Tova. I'm Jason.
Hi, Jason.
Nice to meet you. I'm actually in Vanessa's poetry class as well.
Oh,
so
how
wonderful. When you said your name, I was like, oh, I know that. Where do I know that name from? And it's from the Zoom class. So it's nice to meet you. Just reflecting on this now, I'm brought back to the exercise that we did to... this on Monday, the writing prompt was to get some object and spend a while just, writing some verse describing the object, just however you want. And then the next prompt was to describe how you are relating to the object. So how is it affecting you? So, emotionally or just whatever, what internal process is going on for you in relationship to the object. And my relationship, I found that just doing that process changed my relationship to the object. Like, it started off just like, I was kind of indifferent to it. I was kind of like, whatever. And then by the end of it, the object was imbued with meaning, and I had the initial kind of judgments about the object just kind of faded away, and now I just found a lot of value in it, and I really liked it. So it just kind of a metaphor, just kind of a parallel process to mm-hmm. what goes on with people, right? We have mm-hmm. our initial perceptions that are filtered through our preconceptions, and then if we allow ourselves to get to know it and to reflect on, what's going on inside of us as we get to know this person, both we can be transformed, but, if we allow them to be transformed in how we experience them.
Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. I think that process of noticing, we were invited to describe the object, and it could be any object, very carefully, precisely. And that experience of looking and noticing the details just does create a connection. So that can, thank you for sharing that, yeah. I mean, that's why she started the class by talking about poems that surprise us. But I think when we really look at something, there's a beautiful poem by Mary Oliver called The Summer's Day, where she talks about a grasshopper that lands on her hand, and watching this grasshopper, and it just opens up her experience of something sacred, So we never know when we get to slow down and
meet someone or something with that kind of awareness, what might happen?
Yeah. So, you don't need to see me. No.
We need to see you.
It's okay. So, you know, there's this, and we talk about craving, grasping, and clutching. But one of the things that always gets left out is aversion. We're also, you know, we're like, the other side of that is aversion. And we just, you know, it's like something that says, oh, I don't like this, you know, and we'd never, you know, craving, grasping, and clutching is, we're told to look into that. But, you know, aversion is something that we never look into. And the feeling that I have towards all of these things is their causes and conditions that have created this mind to bring it to this point. But in addition to that, I think there's a sense of control that, you know, if we grasp, we crave, and if we crave, grasp, and clutch, we'll be happy. Or if we avert ourselves, we'll be happy. You know, yet, you know, so we close off any opportunity that is there to really see who we really are in the light of observing, just observing, you know, because we've been taught to do all these things, so we do them. And just like when we sit, we just sit and observe. We just sit and observe something, and, you know, just in that light, there is no control. There's no need to control. Things come, things go. We're not caught up by, yet we go out into the world and then we get caught up by this sense of control that we want to, even I think, you know, gossiping about something, somebody is also a sense of control, that we would want some kind of control, that if they were like this, I would be happy. If they weren't like this, I would be happy. So, you know, sort of we made happiness a very dependent sort of element in our life that is dependent on the outside. Yet most of the time, joy and happiness is not dependent. It's just like everything in life that comes and goes. Yet we want to hold on to joy, we want to become dependent on it, and even by averting something unpleasant, turning our eyes away from something unpleasant, I think there's also a sense of control that we want, you know, that we only want to look at certain things. We don't want to look at certain things. So, you know, for me, that line from the precepts, keeping modesty and extolling others, is a much better way of, you know, saying, yes, this person has value, yes, you know, this person is doing something good, yes, and, you know, I try my best, that's all I can do. And I think that's a much better way of looking at life than getting caught up in that this person didn't do this and that person didn't do that, or that person's better than me and that person's worse than me, and all this stuff that we get caught up into. Because it's somehow joy becomes dependency, and dependency leads you towards a sort of a mental imprisonment. So that's how I was looking at it, like what John was talking about, the sense of freedom that you have. Mm-hmm. It gives you a sense of lightness when you don't do that. That's my feeling towards it.
Thank you, Mark. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably time to end unless somebody else has something they would like to say.
Nobody.
I don't see anybody online. Oh, David. My friend from Enso Village is there. It's a surprise. Hi. Good to see you. Do you want to say something?
How can I say no? I could tell a brief story about spiders. I was staying at the Land of Medicine Buddha outside Sokel, the wonderful Tibetan place that you can stay at. It's kind of a motel. And one of the agreements is to not kill any living things while you're there, very Tibetan idea, including ants and spiders. And so I try to go along with this as much as I can, but I'm come back after one of our workshops and I pull the curtains, and folded up in the curtains is a spider like this, enormous. Yeah, it scared me. I grew up in Florida and I'm quite averse to spiders. So I said, how am I going to get this out of here? And just at that time, a group of women, I don't think they were Tibetans, but they were all dressed in kind of a nun-like costume. So they were in some group. And I said, first I doubted, well, should I approach a group of women about handling a spider? Well, that's a flawed thing to do right there. But I did. I went out there and asked them, what can I do about this spider? And they just barged right into my room and took a tissue and reached up and grasped the spider and let him outside. I was feeling very humble and foolish after all of that, and I'm glad the spider escaped and that I didn't react. So it was quite a problem, quite a... There were other spiders during that stay, but they were smaller and more manageable. But I noticed that, okay, even my best Buddhist thoughts about not harming a spider, this sucker looks terrible. So there was a limit. Thank you for your talk.
You're welcome. Thank you for coming, and thank you for sharing that story. Yeah. Okay, I think that might be time.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's KANNONDO.ORG.